to a remote village in Ethiopia via one of the world's worst roads, to the wheat fields of Punjab, to the jungles of Ecuador, Simran Sethi found the origin's favorite foods. It's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. Journalist and author Sethi was a woman determined to discover how our loss of habitat and diversity is affecting our world's food supply. Of Indian ancestry, Sethi was born in Germany and grew up in North Carolina. But when she learned about the threat of a loss of agricultural biodiversity, Sethi wanted to find out what could be done by traveling to the places where our most precious food and drinks originate. She writes about it in her new book, Bread, Wine, Chocolate. I'll talk to her after the news. It's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese. Today, filling in for Charity Nebbe, and my guest is author, educator, and journalist Simran Sethi. She has a wonderful new book. It's called Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love, and we do love them. Simran, welcome.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
Well, I enjoyed so much reading about all of my favorite foods and beverages, and I think you hit them all. I think they're all included. Except maybe hot sauce.
Oh, gosh.
You can do that next time, right?
Exactly. And it's bread, wine, chocolate, coffee, and beer. So we cover, you know, quite interesting terrain in the book. Indeed.
It is very interesting. And you say this is a book about food, but it's really a book about love. You say it's about the moment when you find yourself savoring something so wholly and intently that you never want to let it go. And I found that to apply to all of these great things we love in our culinary lives. You start with wine.
Yes.
And I love wine. and it's become so popular in areas of the country where it was hard to find 30, 40 years ago. Now it's everywhere. That's a good thing, right?
Indeed. Well, you know, it's in the Yadkin Valley of North Carolina. It's in southern Arizona, of course, in California, in, you know, upstate New York. I mean, it's astonishing to think about where things can grow. But this book was really born out of the question of why aren't we growing more varieties and why aren't we creating more diversity? When I first started exploring this topic, I was in Italy and I met scientist after scientist who said, you know, we're really concerned about the loss of genetic erosion and the loss of agricultural biodiversity. And I had been working, Dennis, like through food issues in all of my environmental work. I was kind of funneling it all through food because it was what was most interesting and compelling to me. I think about food all the time. And you know, when they said this, I thought, I don't know what you're talking about. And I'm someone who's quite food oriented. I'd heard about kind of the loss of diversity in foods that weren't really already a part of my diet. So maybe an obscure indigenous squash or a wild rice variety I'd never heard of or what have you. But what I learned, I spent 5 years on 6 continents researching and writing this book, was that the loss of agricultural biodiversity is impacting every food and drink we consume. And it's effectively the loss of diversity in everything that makes food and agriculture possible. So it's the loss of diversity in the soil. It's the loss of diversity in seeds, in pollinators, in plants, in animals, in aquatic life, you know, including fish, that it's really something where we're creating like a food pyramid, but the point is as fine as, you know, Seattle Space Needle, where putting risk into our food system by limiting diversity. So the equivalent would be kind of an investment. So you would never put all of your money in like 2 stocks, you know, for the future. If you had any money to invest, you wouldn't think that was the best way to secure your financial future. Yet with food, that's exactly what we're doing. So I wanted to explore why this was happening, you know, why now our diet, 3/4 of the world's food comes from 12 plant and 5 animal species. And, you know, we're trending toward a diet that researchers have coined the global standard diet, which is basically wheat, rice, corn, soybean, and palm oil. So I wanted to understand why it looked like there was diversity that I hadn't seen before, and then tease out kind of this, you know, this concern that scientists had, and then figure out how we, the eaters, could have power in helping transform the food system. So that's how the journey started. And it largely, not only does the book start with wine, but the journey started there because it was through a wine grape that is grown in California mm-hmm. called the Trousseau Gris.
Now, a grape that I had never heard of, and it's very limited in where you can find it. You fell in love with this wine. And I was reading the book thinking, gosh, I wish I could taste this wine. I don't know if it's available in my local stores or not. But
it's not available in your local stores, largely because a lot of the wine that's shipped, it comes from large distributors. If it's shipped across the country, you know, wine is pretty expensive to move around the world because of the glass bottles. But Scott Schultz is the maker, and he's grown increasingly popular. I love that he's gotten just a tiny bit more attention from the book, but he's gotten it from everywhere, and it's well-deserved. And this wine that he made is from a grape called Trousseau Gris, and it's this spectacular white wine grape that it's sweet, but it's not cloying. It's got a lot of minerality in it, so it's kind of there's a sharpness to it, a real brightness. And for me, even though I spent a lot of time in Italy researching this book, wine just wasn't my thing. I mean, I know it's your thing, but mine's chocolate. So for me, it's like, I like wine. You know, I like wine. I'll have it at dinner, but I'm not going to deny it. I kind of was doing it just for a little bit for taste, but also for the buzz. You know, I wasn't getting drunk, but that I was enjoying the conviviality of wine as a beverage, but not as a specific thing that I was seeking out. And I describe in the book, that wine reached for me.
Yeah, right.
It was unlike anything I had ever experienced. So what I did was, at this point, when I was writing the book was about kind of more of the global standard diet foods, right? So I was writing a book called maybe Wheat, Rice, Corn, mm-hmm. you know, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. I don't know who would have bought that book, but, you know, that was kind of where my mind was. And I thought, oh, I'll sprinkle a little wine on top. I'll throw in some, you know, chocolate for color. But those were just going to be teeny tiny fragments, you know, mm-hmm. just a little sizzle on the side, not the core. And, you know, when I tasted this wine, I thought to myself, there are all these stories that are culminating in this glass. And I just, you know, it was a very casual interaction. I talked to, you know, the server. I said, you know, surprise me, which I never do. She brought me this glorious glass of wine. It was almost orange in color because of the amount of time he leaves the skins on, the skin contact.
Yeah.
And then she said, oh, well, you know, the wine director here at the restaurant's Camino, the wine director is Caleb Taft. He can give you a little bit more information. The maker is right here, you know, when I sort of chit-chatted about the book. And what I found out was this grape is an underutilized grape. It is a grape that could grow prolifically in California, in Northern California, but it is only cultivated commercially on one 10-acre plot, which is tiny. And you think about, there's like 7 or 8 wine grapes that are really dominant in California, but we can grow so much more.
The funny thing is that you talk about lack of diversity in all of these things in wine grapes, but you go into even a grocery store here in Iowa and find hundreds of different labels of wine. And it's just an amazing variety. But a lot of it, you say in your book, is coming from just, what, 3 or 4 types of grape, right?
Well, the interesting thing is that 90% of our wine grapes are from one species called Vitis vinifera. And then in California, which is the, you know, one of the largest wine producers in the world, the majority of vineyards are dedicated to just 8 grape varieties. It's Cabernet Sauvignon, it's Chardonnay, it's Merlot, it's Pinot Noir, it's Sauvignon Blanc, Syrah, Zinfandel, and Pinot Gris. And you know, the interesting thing is exactly what you just said. There are hundreds of labels there, but they're not hundreds of grapes. They're not hundreds of varieties of grapes. And, you know, it's not only less interesting, which is kind of where I come from in this book. I want us to think about not just this kind of random kind of notion of erosion in diversity and genetics, but that it's a real cultural erosion when everything looks and tastes the same. And that when we move toward the varieties that are most familiar, the varieties that have the highest yield, and discredit all these other things, we're really losing something that's special about us. You know, if you go to the grocery store, I did this experiment, you know, kind of what you just said about wine with dairy products. And I counted, Walmart's the largest grocery chain now in the United States. Mm-hmm. I counted something like over 153 flavors of ice cream.
Right.
And then you can go down, I mean, just go through the dairy list, you know, the sour cream, the cottage cheese, all the yogurts, you know, the wave of Greek yogurt we never had, you know, 5-10 years ago. But 90% of them come from one breed of cow. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, if you're only growing eight varieties of grapes, or you're only, you know, 90% of your dairy is coming from one cow, we only see one banana in our grocery stores. We grow 1,000 bananas globally. What happens when one disease wipes all those things out?
And that's actually happening with the Cavendish. That's the banana that we eat. And you mentioned that until the early 50s or something, we were eating another variety. I forgot the name, but that was wiped out by some fungus. And now the Cavendish is also being threatened. And any of these things can be threatened. I'm thinking wine grapes. We limit the number of grapes we grow, and what another fungus comes by or some insect problem, and what happens?
Well, and we have proof of this. That's the shocking thing, specifically with wine, specifically with the varieties, the vines, the grape, they call it the Great French Wine Blight. And in the 1890s, all of French vineyards were replanted with rootstocks that were grafted, they grafted the vines onto American rootstock, because the vines from that region were all vulnerable to this little sap-sucking insect called phylloxera. And then when it comes to what you just said about the banana, which is happening right now, right? So we can scroll back to the 1800s, right? And then we can fast forward to the 21st century and say we're seeing history repeat itself. And I can cite examples in between, whether it's, you know, the potato famine that happened in Ireland, whether it's the challenges that happened around, you know, the famine in Ethiopia in the 1980s, that all of these things point to limiting the availability that allows us to be resilient, that allows us to respond to changes. So when it comes to this banana, the banana that you were referencing earlier that was there in the 1950s is known as the Gros Michel or the Big Mike banana.
This was the banana that I was probably eating as a small child. And how was it different from the Cavendish?
It was sweeter. So it was a kind of banana, like as a consumer, it's the kind of banana that we would have wanted, right? It was, yeah. I don't personally go to a store and buy anything for disease resistance or for yield. I'm choosing it for taste. I'm choosing it for connection to who I am, for memory. Oh, I remember my grandmother used to cook with this, or, oh, I love these, you know, when I see them in season or what have you. And with the banana, you were eating as a child a sweeter banana that had lower starch content. Mm. And now we see this banana was created solely in response to the fungus that wiped out the Gros Michel, right? The Big Mike banana. Now we see this a different strain of the exact same fungus wiping out the Cavendish, which is our current banana.
Simran, hold on a minute. We have to take a break. So hold on. We'll be back in a minute talking to Simran Sadie, her new book, Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. She'll be reading at Prairie Lights Books tomorrow night at 7, Tuesday night at 7, also a chocolate tasting there. Wednesday, leading a panel discussion called Hog Farming, Sustainability, and a Tale of Delicious Bacon. That's in the UI Business College starting at 5:30 p.m. Wednesday. Thursday this week, she'll be telling stories of science, how to write science, presentation at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, the Day House in Iowa City, starting at 4 p.m. Thursday. Back with Simran Sadie in a minute. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity.
Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today. We got string beans and onions. Goodbye.
Welcome back to Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe, talking to environmental writer, author Simran Sadie. Her new book is Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. She's in Iowa City through Thursday. Simran, before the break, we were talking bananas, lack of diversity there. The current banana we eat, called the Cavendish, is under threat, and that may go away.
Now, one could say technology will save us. So plant geneticists are hard at work trying to create a new banana that will stand strong on store shelves and, you know, ship well and all this stuff. But we could also diversify. That is a smart, low-tech, accessible form of agriculture to not grow things all, you know, these, we have monocultures, you know, abound, and now we have this kind of shrinking mono diet on a global scale that really points to, like, an increase in risk through a reduction of diversity. So we need diversity because we need to be able to breed in traits that are going to help us in the future.
Does it make any sense to buy the organic shade-grown bananas from a whole Foods or a Whole Food, local version of Whole Foods, co-op. It's still the same banana, but are we wise to get the organic variety? Does that help?
So I will speak to two of both of those things that you just said. Organic is about a form of like management, right? We are not in organic agriculture. There is no application of synthetic chemicals to the crop. So, you know, any herbicides, pesticides, what have you that are used are all, you know, natural. That's a strange way to kind of parse it out. But I think people are often under the misconception that nothing is used. It's like, no. There is application. There can be application of something, but it won't be synthetically derived. When it comes to shade grown, so that's just, you know, that's one interesting route to take, but that has more to do with kind of the implications for what happens on the ground and what might happen to farmers. In some ways, it can be restricting when farmers aren't able to use these synthetic chemicals. There's right now happening, 2013, we saw Guatemala, Costa Rica, and Honduras declare states of emergency because of coffee leaf rust, which has wiped out Arabica coffee. That's the majority of our good coffee is Arabica coffee in the country. And again, because they were encouraged to grow these crops in full sun in monoculture, one disease comes in and they lose everything. There is not a natural organic, solution to this problem. So they have to use chemicals to respond to coffee leaf rust. So that, I think, is something where I like to have a little bit of flexibility, but I always err toward organic. When it comes to shade grown, there is no certification for preserving biodiversity. That doesn't exist. And there are so many certification protocols, it's dizzying to me as a consumer. But what shade grown does is it says that it was grown in a way that makes it part of a big O ecosystem. And I would say it's the closest certification that we get to preserving biodiversity, because it's ensuring that that plant wasn't just grown alone. And one of the most beautiful things I found is that that diversity makes everything stronger. It makes communities stronger. It makes ecosystems stronger. And so whenever possible, I'm certainly looking for shade grown products.
Right. And I'm talking to Simran Sethi. Your new book is Bread, Wine, and Chocolate, Slow Loss of the Foods We Love. Simran, you went to the far corners of the earth to write this book. It's really interesting to read about the difficult places you were able to arrive at to come up with some excellent research in all of these foods and drinks. And I'm thinking, you mentioned the coffee beans, and you were in the forest, the deep forest, where just coffee grows wild. And I'm thinking, why can't they just harvest that? But you get into some really complex issues and questions. It's not as easy as it sounds to harvest coffee right from the forest, correct?
Right. Can I read to you something that just helps give a little taste of
Yes.
So I'll back up before I read it and just say, one of the things I didn't realize when I thought about diversity was there is a deep origin for every food and drink. So apples, for example, were born in China.
Okay.
Yeast, which is the most diversity and the origins we think of brewer's yeast and baker's yeast, is also China. The Middle East is the home of wheat. And what that's done for me is really helped me realize how the world shows up on my plate. So, for example, when something feels very far away, there's an earthquake right now, and they're scared of yet an aftershock kind of experience happening in Ecuador. Over 500 people have died. Every cacao growing region in Ecuador was impacted. Cacao is what becomes chocolate, and the birthplace of cacao is a bean-shaped area that crosses Ecuador and Peru. So you may not in your day-to-day activities think about Ecuador, but if you've eaten chocolate today, you have done so for the grace of Ecuador, because that's where it began. So when it comes to coffee was born in Ethiopia. It is an African crop. And that was so humbling to me because, I had some vague notion of, farmers in fields and workers in factories. And I thought it came from, coffee came from Central America somewhere, by the grace of Juan Valdez, which is, Colombia did an incredible marketing campaign around coffee. Great varieties grow there, of course. But the place where it began was Ethiopia. And so I decided to go there. I tried to go to the deep origins of a few places in the book. And when I landed in the capital, Addis Ababa, it was the middle of the night, and I was so disoriented. But the thing that became apparent, I was there for 3 weeks, was that I had only been given one narrow story about what Ethiopia was. People are small and big. The places are dusty and lush. And everyone, what was so astonishing to me was everyone who greeted me, you extend your arm and one hand tucks underneath your elbow and your other arm is extended. And people would say, how are you? But they would immediately follow that with, how is your family? And it was so humbling to be in a place where you realize that you were part of a bigger whole. And I think about coffee, you know, when we think about coffee breaks, and I start this story in the coffee chapter of talking about like wrapping myself up in a blanket in Kansas and going through deep heartbreak and, you know, a really intense work time. And I, you know, I loved me a coffee and a cigarette, you know, morning to set the tone of the morning. And it was just those few moments were mine alone. And I point that out not to say, I mean, I'm not a smoker really now. I wouldn't mind one now and again, but that like this isn't about me being some fancy person. You know, I started my wine journey with a Bartles and James wine cooler. You know, I started my beer journey with some horrible, probably some kegger, you know, in high school. I mean, it's just that this, you don't have to be fancy. There's no difference here.
I know you wanted to read a section, so I'll let you choose something.
Great. Well, I'd love to share about this idea of like who, how do we make our food system better and more delicious? And when conservationists talk about saving this diversity that I was referencing, you know, they talk about saving it out of place, ex situ conservation. So you think of something like a seed bank, right? We've got Seed Saver Exchange in Decorah is a perfect example of what it means to save seeds out of place. But what Seed Saver Exchange does that's so beautiful is it also participates in situ conservation, in place conservation. This takes place in the form of in situ conservation on farms. So we save these diverse varieties by growing them. It's one thing to kind of store them in a seed vault, freeze dry them, keep them, you know, like tucked away, but we also need them to respond to changing climates, to our environments, to changing tastes and what have you. The third way we save, we conserve biodiversity is in situ conservation in the wild. So that's why I went to Ethiopia, to the wild places of Ethiopia, to see where coffee grows, where it comes from, and where it's what we call the crop wild relatives are, which are the diverse varieties that we might need in the future that we might not consume, but they might have traits we might need to breed in.
I should mention, this is a country that takes its coffee very seriously. Fascinating. They love it. And just in the morning, they actually roast their own beans right there in their houses, right?
Indeed. You think the expert is your barista, you know, and the roaster down the street. And let me tell you something. Like, that's what's been so humbling. Like, the experts aren't the people we know. They're not the one whose names are familiar to us. You know, many times people think about chocolate coming from places like Belgium or, you know, coffee coming from Italian cafes or Viennese cafes and what have you. And really, these things started in humble places. They started in the global south and they attain value and they become these products that we consume. So for me, this is really an exploration, not only of these foods, but of the story of the farmers whose hands helped shape it. But it's also the story of us. Food is our identity. Food is something that we have intimate relationships with. We, you know, we celebrate with it. We mourn through it. I thought about with chocolate, you know, it was my birthday cake and my wedding cake, but it also got me through my divorce. You know, it wrote every page of this book. We're going to celebrate by tasting the place of chocolate, the taste of place through an exploration of different origins of chocolate at Prairie Lights on Tuesday. And you know, what I wanted to do is bring more power to us because conservationists look at ex situ, in situ conservation, you know, in these two places in the wild and on farm. But they don't look to us, the eaters, and farmers can't grow what we don't eat. So I'd like to just share a little bit about what taste means.
All right, good.
Taste is something we all do and all have. It doesn't just belong to foodies or sophisticates. Each of us owns and shapes this construct. What we feel about tasting and eating, what we savor, shouldn't be discriminatory or hierarchical. Because if we operate from the premise that only certain people own taste, then there's no point in exploring. We should all just frequent the places that have collected the most promising Yelp reviews or greatest number of Michelin stars. I refuse to do that. I refuse to let someone else define what deliciousness is for me. To whatever extent I can, I want to define and redefine what tastes good. I want to define what is good for me. And I want you to do the same for you, because taste is both universal and personal. What each and every one of us cherishes matters. And to me, now just stepping away from the excerpt, it's really about empowering us. You know, I've been working in environmental issues for well over a decade, and the solutions sometimes feel so scarce. Put on a sweater, walk, turn down the thermostat, you know, and here the solution is like dig in there, feast on your life, savor your food, ask the questions about where it comes from, and be grateful and be curious. And that isn't just about, you know, effete fancy foods. This is about your craft beer as much as it is about your specialty coffee. And we all have an opportunity to play a role in making this better. And we shape it seed by seed and meal by meal and, you know, coffee by coffee and beer by beer.
Well, you say dig in, but at the same time, slow down. I know when it comes to when I was reading your wonderful chapter on chocolate, I mean, I do buy better quality chocolate, dark chocolate now. I love it. But now I'm slowing down a bit, trying to enjoy it more rather than just wolf it down. And you were out there in the cacao fields looking at in these villages, and very interesting to learn how they harvest these beans from these large pods. These skinny little, they're barely connected to the tree, just sort of easy to chop down, and then the pulp, and then separating the seed. You had great fun, I could tell, learning about how this chocolate is made.
Shall I read to you?
Yeah.
None of it was what I expected. Not the smell of damp earth, not the sight of scentless white blossoms the size of my fingernail, or pods the length of my forearm. Astonishing grooved footballs in green, yellow, orange, red, and purple, growing straight out of tree trunks. Not the sound of the pods thudding to the ground with a swift jab of the palanca, a sharp blade on an extended wooden pole that stabs at the small expanse between the pod stem and trunk. Or the sound of pods cracking open with the whoosh of a machete or hard strike against a tree. Not the warm, sticky flesh. I hadn't fully conceived of what a chocolate forest would look like, but it wasn't this, a fantastical Dr. Seuss dream made manifest. Chocolate comes from cacao, not to be confused with coca, the shrub that becomes cocaine. The fruits are ridged, oblong, or round, roughly the size of large cantaloupes or American footballs. Spanning a range of colors, they can be both smooth and mottled, and are attached to tree trunks and thick branches by surprisingly thin stems, less than 1/4 of an inch thick. The pods grow vertically out of wide branches and trunks of trees, and their placement looks haphazard, like a botanical game of pin the tail on the donkey. The pulp inside the fruit, the flesh covering the seeds, is warm, sticky, and sweet. However, cacao is harvested not for the flesh, but for the seeds that we mistakenly refer to as beans. Those seeds, once processed, are what become cocoa and chocolate. And chocolate, as we well know, is a miracle substance.
Oh, and it doesn't taste like chocolate until it's fully processed and roasted, and then so you don't really...
It goes through such a transformation, Dennis. That was what was so spectacular to me. I had no idea, first of all, that bread, wine, coffee, chocolate, and beer were all fermented foods. So that in and of itself was really like, wow, right from the beginning, I've chosen things that really undergo this extraordinary transformation.
So chocolate, I was surprised to hear that chocolate is also fermented.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a critical part. Actually, you know, the flavors that end up in chocolate are largely due to fermentation. And, you know, chocolate that's fermented well is an extraordinary thing. We often don't understand this or taste it because, you know, we've hidden the chocolate under peanuts, caramel, nougat, biscuits, you know, or with our coffee, like it's doused with whipped cream and caramel and, you know, all kinds of things. And it's like, well, it doesn't really matter what the original substance tastes like. But I really believe that those tastes do matter. And if we want to settle, if we want to keep moving toward mediocrity and get like a less delicious banana, a less delicious cup of coffee, then we're going to be okay. But I don't want to settle. I don't want to settle for something that is goes into my body and helps me live, that represents not only the energy that gets me through the day, but a reflection of who I am in the world and my life, my ancestors, my place. You know, this is what food is. We, you know, we are what we eat and we eat what we are, is what a dear friend of mine said when we traveled together. And I think people really get that. So all of a sudden, the world, environmental challenges, social challenges kind of become real because, you know, we're eating them every single day.
Talking to Simran Sadie, her new book is Bread, Wine, Chocolate. She's an environmental journalist and author. And you talk a lot in the book about, Simran, about it's not just taste, it's smell. So actually, that's where a lot of the enjoyment comes from. And I was thinking one of the most heavenly smells of ever experienced was a couple of years ago. We were in South Carolina at a tea plantation, America's only tea plantation in South Charleston. And the smell of the tea and being roasted or processed in the factory and the tea bushes, it was just absolutely heavenly. And you need to talk about tea, I think, in your next book. You left tea
you're
out.
Indian. Why isn't tea in the book? And I was like, because I actually drink coffee. You know, it was a very, and I say this, map these concerns, map these stories onto whatever it is you love, whether it's tea or kale. Yeah. You know, whatever you love is under risk as well. And sure. You're absolutely right. I go through every sense in the book to help people understand what flavor is, because so many times not only have, you know, the kind of suggestions felt scarce, but they've also felt like kind of like esoteric and hard. You know, I read books where it's like, okay, you need to start growing things and fermenting things and roast your own pig. And then, you know, we're going to solve these problems. It's like, well, what if I just want to eat well? Like, what if I want to support the people doing it and go to farmers markets? I don't want to grow my own, you know, but I want to support the people who do it well.
Simran, hold that thought. We need to take a break. Talking to Simran Sadie. We'll be back in a minute. Her new book is Bread, Wine, Chocolates, Slow Loss, Foods We Love. She's in Iowa City this week. This is Talk of Iowa.
Coffee and tea and the java and me.
Welcome back to Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese, sitting in today for Charity Nebbe, talking to Simran Sadie, an environmental journalist and author of a brand new great book called Bread, Wine, Chocolate, Slow Loss of Foods We Love. She's in Iowa City this week. And Simran, we were sort of just starting to talk about bread a bit before the break, right?
Absolutely. The bread chapter is one of my favorites because it points again to the universality of bread. When scientists saw the subjects that I was covering, you know, some of them were a little perplexed. It's like, we're going to be okay without beer. You know that, right? And I said, well, I want to talk about things that are anchors for people that we have these deep relationships with. But wheat is, it's one of our nutritional staples. It's also one of our spiritual staples. So I really sort of explored through that. And what I love was what the baker that I talked to in North Carolina said about communion. And her grandfather was a Eucharistic minister. And this notion of nourishment, of feeding ourselves, of feeding our community, being something that extends beyond what we put on our plate. And that really is kind of the broad theme of everything that I'm doing in Iowa. It's how do we feed each other well? And what does that really mean? You know, at Prairie Lights, I'm going to be sharing the book directly in that journey. And we're going to taste chocolate so we can really get that embodied experience of agrobiodiversity. But what I also wanted to do, Iowa is like my home state of North Carolina. It's a place where, you know, the pork industry has flourished. And, you know, you were referencing smell earlier, Dennis, and my immediate thought went to the smell of bacon. You know, that's what like hits home for me. I mean, my mouth can start to water just thinking about it. Yeah. And, you know, the industry has changed remarkably in the last several decades, not only due to consolidation and, you know, kind of the shifting shape of business, but also like the way we raise animals and how livestock is treated and how the environments around the pigs are treated. So I wanted to do an exploration of the pork industry within the context of the business school, because my background is in sustainable business. That's what I have my business degree in. But that there are models that show us how we can experience this in a new way, and how we can, you know, like, have our bacon and save the planet too. And so the people who are going to be exploring this with me are people who've been exploring this from a variety of angles: academic, within the industry, within the supply chain, to really explore what those narratives are. The dominant narrative often seems to be like, we have to do things in this way. We have to compromise public health or safety of animals or what have you. You know, we have to create highly processed foods because this is the only way we can feed people. And I think that narrative is only partially true. And we have a real opportunity in every space to sort of look at what the stories are that we are being told and what kind of the facts are behind those stories. So we'll explore that, you know, with pork in our conversation on Wednesday. And then we'll follow that up at the Writers' Workshop, really looking at how do we tell the stories of science in ways that bring the world close up. It was a very deliberate evolution in my journey with this book, in the work that I do, to bring these issues close up. And it was really born out of grief and frustration that I was talking about environmental issues and I was being asked to tell the same story over and over mm-hmm. again. Yeah. I was trotted out, you know, for Earth Day on the Oprah Winfrey Show. And I remember in the third year, the producer called and she said, "Simran, is there anything exciting in weather stripping?" <You know? laughs> And I was like, "No, it's still weather stripping." Yeah. Like, I mean, it's like insulate your house. You know, and it was just that degree. And I remember being with Oprah talking about environmentally friendly home cleaning products. And in my head, the question was like, what am I doing wrong? And so I spent years researching the psychological barriers to environmental engagement. And I really think a key part of that, which I'll explore, you know, more at the Writers' Workshop, is around narrative and around the stories that we tell about ourselves, about each other, and the stories that we kind of receive about the world.
Well, you have a very interesting story yourself, because you are Indian American, mm-hmm. correct? But you grew up in North Carolina. So you're a southern person.
Yeah.
But you went back to India to research mm-hmm. the book, to sort of reminisce and honor your late grandmother, who was quite a cook. But there was an interesting chapter on sort of a ceremonial, I don't know how to describe it.
Kara Prasad.
Thank you. Say it again.
Yep, you bet. Kara Prasad.
It sounds absolutely heavenly. But you went way in the back of the temple to watch them make this 4 a.m. or something. I'm sorry. So they started midnight. Anyway, explain what this is about.
Sure. So they run in shifts all day. It's the holiest temple for the Sikh faith in the world. It's really pronounced Sikh, S-I-K-H, and it comes from the word Sikhna, which means to learn. The final incarnation of the holy teacher is the book, and it's called the Siddhi Guru Granth Sahib. And that book is stored at the holiest temple for Sikhs in the world, which is in Amritsar, in the state of India, in Punjab, which is the wheat state of India. So it's ironic. I'm talking to you from Kansas, the wheat state of the United States right now.
Right.
And I trace the story, two stories in every chapter, and the story I trace around wheat is in North Carolina, which is the place that I grew up. But also, I do go back to India, to my ancestral home state, and trace the wheat from the holiest temple all the way back to the fields. And this food, I mean, you could kind of like compare it to communion, you know, to a communion wafer, mm-hmm. in the sense of it's an embodiment, it's a blessing, right? It's not the body of God, but is a representative of what God brings us.
But it's pretty simple. I mean, as far as the ingredients go.
Oh yeah, it's water. It's water. It's wheat. It says water, flour, sugar, and clarified butter. So it's a like sweeter, more buttery cream of wheat is basically what it is.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, and you don't just get it at the Golden Temple, which is the largest, which is this holy temple. You get it. You can get them here in the United States. You can get it at any Hindu or Sikh temple in the world. You will get this edible blessing. And I would go with my grandmother. We do like the circuit, you know.
Yeah.
And I was like, I got holy dessert again. This is awesome, you know. And I never thought of it as an edible blessing. And then I thought, okay, well, it must become holy when the priests chant prayers over it. And it was only through the journey of India. It was actually really, I was there for days. It was in the last few hours that I finally learned. And it was, you know, a mixture of me not fully understanding what was going on and jet lag and translation. But it took a while for me to understand. The moment it becomes holy is when it is shared. Mm. And I thought that was so symbolic. It's like, this is the beauty of what we have. You know, no matter where I went in the world, I was on six continents, as I mentioned, what people offered me of themselves, their time, their food, their coffee, whatever it was sacred, you know? And that sanctity showed up when I was referencing Tara Jensen, the baker, earlier. You know, she was referencing like Wonder Bread sandwiches. And she said, this is communion too. And this is coming from a baker who, you know, uses heritage grains, who has her own wood-fired oven, you know. And she's like, all of that is communion. All of that is holy to me. And I really firmly believe that.
What was your grandmother like?
My granny. My nanny was, first of all, so beautiful. Uh-huh. And she was a little chubby, you know, and she laughed a lot. And she had perfect white teeth. I mean, it was astonishing. And she, every morning she would wake up and she would do a salutation to the sun. And I would go outside with her, and then I would go. Many Hindus have temples, like prayer rooms in their house. And I would sit with her from a very young age. You know, I go back and forth to India my whole life. I was born in Germany, but the very first language I spoke was Hindi, actually, as a toddler. But I would sit with her while she would pray. It was just so remarkable to get to spend time with somebody who was highly superstitious, you know, who would like want to hear all the kind of, she was very gossipy, she was very superstitious, but she was also really grounded and really spiritual. And the taste that I have on my tongue came from her. And I realized then how sacred food was, how emotional and intimate food was. When I was staying, I was in Fez with a friend of mine. We were traveling there and I ate something Moroccan, you know, it was like a Moroccan dessert. And all of a sudden I started like weeping on the street. And it was because it brought my grandmother right back to me. It wasn't the same food, but there was something about that flavor that I recognized, and I recognized it so deeply. And I think that's what I don't want to lose. I don't want to lose these genetics, but I also don't want to lose the longer story of who we are, the memories of foods our grandmother cooked for us, or the places that we loved, or fruits that used to be in season. You know, that those things matter. And I think to me, that's what I've realized through this journey of trying to tell stories about environmentalism. You know, one of the biggest takeaways is that intimacy is not a bad thing, that we often try to use facts, you know, drown people with data. But psychologists show that data doesn't change people's decision making, because that's not how we move in the world. The things that sway us are people and stories and not wanting to lose things that we love.
You say in the book that the world has expanded in terms of the amount, calories, fat, and protein, with the greatest number of our calories now coming from energy-dense foods such as wheat and potatoes. Really, we have an obesity epidemic in the United States and probably a couple of other advanced countries as well. It just seems so ironic. We're eating more, not eating what we should be eating.
It's so ironic that it's a global phenomenon now.
It is a global phenomenon.
Globally die from being overweight or obese, from diseases related to overweight or obesity, than from being underweight. But they're all malnourished. We are, as author Raj Patel says, stuffed and starved. So we are starved of micronutrients. And that's what we find in diverse foods and less processed foods. You know, these paradoxes are so interesting. One in five people in the United States is food insecure, which is a kind of abstract way of saying people are hungry, you know, and at the same time, we're throwing 40% of our food away, and 30 to 40% of our population is overweight or obese. And, you know, the refrain is often, this is when I'm going back to this notion of like, what is the dominant narrative, is that, well, we have to create all this cheap food because people need to eat. But we create 1.5 times enough food to feed every single person on the planet today and in 2050. But ironically, some of the hungriest people in the world are small farmers, because they don't have the money. Yeah. They don't have the resources. And so what I want to do is shift this question from, is this all we can afford, to why aren't people paid enough to afford to be able to feed themselves well? Why are we, the United States, the you know, a developed country that spends the least amount of our disposable income on food? As a percentage, we spend less of a percentage of our income on food than we did during the Great Depression. So when we talk about value, it's really a question of, what do we want to invest in? Some people are like, I can't do all this research. What do you want me to do? Like, learn the deep story of everything? No, but pick one thing. If craft beer is your thing, then figure out where that beer came from. You know, flip over a package in the grocery store. Pick out something you've never seen before at the farmer's market. Be curious. the researchers that kind of ascertained or defined this global trend, on a local level, we do see, like when you see a mango in Iowa in December, you know, that's not endemic. That's an increase in diversity, but that's globalization. But the global trend is towards sameness. And he said, eating olive oil, and this is his phrase, not mine. This is a conservation scientist, not me. Eating olive oil is now a radical act. So this is about a pivot in the grocery store. This is about small changes as well as dramatic ones. But that means there is room for every single one of us to take part in the solution.
It was really stunning, Simran, to read in your book about the small farmers in many countries who work literally day and night. And they are food insecure, as you just mentioned. They don't have enough money to feed themselves well. And it's just, it seems really tragic.
It is. And, you know, I have to say, it's really tragic that that's happening right here, Dennis. It's tragic in developing countries, but there's also a degree of expectation, right, that these are poor places. But in the richest countries in the world, no kids should be going to bed hungry. You know, 30 to 40% of African American and Latino American children are hungry. And that to me is unconscionable, that we can do so much better as a nation to make sure that people are fed. We can't solve every problem, but this is one that is well within our reach.
We just have a couple of minutes left. And Simran, you noted at the beginning of our conversation that you went to 6 continents over 5 years. It's really fun to read about all these places you went to, and you were not afraid to get to some very remote areas where some very interesting food is grown, for everything from wine grapes to wheat to coffee. What place did you find the most interesting?
The place that I found the most interesting is the one that stays with me the most, and that would have to be Ethiopia. I went to these, you know, the coffee forest, as I told you. So we save the forest, but the way that we're able to save it in part is by putting a value on it. And we put that value on it by figuring out what's growing there and saying, hey, this coffee, let's put a value on this coffee. And these two men, I mean, it took, you know, an hour that would take, like a journey that would take a couple hours, you know, here in the U.S. took 11 hours because
right.
of the roads, you know, and because of the car and because of the petrol and all this. And the two gentlemen that were there said, thank you. And I said, you know, to everybody I met, I said, is there anything you wish people knew? And they just said, thank you for telling our story. And I asked them to hold out their hands. I took pictures of hands. You can find this on my Facebook page. I took pictures of people's hands, and they thought I was nuts, you know. But 18 sets of hands, give or take, are what it takes to bring us our cup of coffee in the morning. And this calculation was done by the director of the Specialty Coffee Association of America. His name is Peter Giuliano. He did like a back of an envelope kind of estimate for me. But that is so humbling to me, how hard it is to get something so exquisite and how I simply hadn't ever considered the journey. A journey that, I mean, they set the tone of every morning of my adult life starts with coffee. And I'd never once considered how my hopes, how my dreams was bound up with theirs. And all of a sudden, I understood it. And I knew that I wanted to make decisions that would help not only make my life better and more delicious, but that as a byproduct would make their life better too. And it's not a difference between like, oh, can I afford a latte from Starbucks today? You know, the questions are like, will I be able to get medicine for my children? Yeah. You know, will I be able to feed myself today? And that to me is a really big thing. I can spend a couple of extra dollars on food. I can make these decisions. If I can't, then I'll make different kinds of decisions. But for me, this is an area where I want to invest. And as Peter Giuliano says, he said, there's no cup of coffee that is delicious no matter where it comes from if people aren't treated well.
Certainly.
So that's what I kind of use as my edict.
Simran Sadie, thanks so much. Just a lot of fun talking to you. The book is fabulous. Thank you. I hope you have a great time in Iowa and you have more explorations and more writing. We'll look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and I know I will have a great time in Iowa.
Okay, good. Simran Sadie, her new book, Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. Now, she is in Iowa City tomorrow, Tuesday, reading at Prairie Lights at 7 p.m., and there will also be a chocolate tasting, Prairie Lights, 7 p.m. tomorrow, downtown Iowa City. On Wednesday, she'll be the facilitator and moderator at the University of Iowa College of Business, the seminar called Hog Farming Sustainability, The Tale of Delicious Bacon. Perfect topic for Iowa. That's at 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday this week at the UI Business College. And on Thursday, she'll be sharing some insights into the art of communicating science and the role psychology can play in fostering science journalism. to the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. That starts at 4 p.m. on Thursday in the Day House. Of course, the Writers' Workshop House is open to the public on Thursday the 28th. That's Talk of Iowa for today. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. Thanks for tuning in.